This podcast is made possible by the generosity of supporting members. Please visit dharmaocean.org to learn more about becoming a supporting member. You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. In today's talk, Reggie discusses the history of Mahamudra and Dzogchen lineages in Tibetan Buddhism. He says that recent scholarship in Buddhist studies has revealed the influence of Chan Buddhism on the spirituality of Vajrayana Buddhism. These discoveries demonstrate the flexible dynamism of the Mahamudra tradition. This talk was given at the 2014 Mahamudra for the Modern World Retreat, held in Crestone, Colorado.
Now, of course, you all know what I'm leading up to, which is Shikhan Taza. Now, here's an interesting thing. I know that a number of people, if not everybody, is feeling a little claustrophobic with the form. Am I in the right neighborhood? But let's put it this way. Did Caroline give you the instruction about don't move? Was that part of it? Yeah. If you move, here's the thing. During meditating with the body, you receive a lot of pointing out. I don't know if everyone knows what that is, but pointing out is working with the space, like what we did yesterday, and all of a sudden things open up and you're right there and you feel, okay. Okay. When we come to Shikhan Taza, there is a way to stabilize that experience. And the way to stabilize it, or let's put it the other way, as long as you are moving around when you're sitting, moving around is, if you explore this, and I invite you to explore it, we're sitting and we feel like moving. We want to do this, we want to scratch our head, we want to, you know, adjust our back. And if people don't have the instruction to not move, sitting up here, the whole room is in motion the whole entire time. Everybody's moving. You know, every couple of minutes people are moving and adjusting, and, you know, clothes. And now, if you look into it yourself, in terms of your own thing, every time you move, unless it's deliberate, unless you have planned to move, and we'll talk about that, but 99.9% of all movement is impulsive movement, you might notice that every time you do it, it's because some painful thought or feeling came up and you're trying to get away from it. And moving is a way of distracting yourself from it so you don't have to feel. And movement is also a way of distracting yourself from your own inner space. Now you might think, well, actually, I want to feel the inner stillness. I want to feel the vastness of my own inner being. Well, yes and no. Because in order to do that, we have to actually let go of the constant fiddling that undergirds our sense of our ego, of our identity. The fiddling is a way of maintaining our ego. That's what we're doing when we're moving around. We're maintaining our sense of a small self. And we're doing it because it's familiar, it feels secure. Whereas the big space, you have to actually let the whole thing go. And that, at every stage of the journey, that's a challenge to do it. So the only way to open up the inner space in a continuous way is to not move. And what happens, and that's the sort of kind of, that's why not moving is such an important part of shikantaza. Now I grant you, in the beginning, it's going to feel very claustrophobic, and for the ego, it's totally claustrophobic, I grant you that. Because we're so used to moving around and doing things, and you know, every impulse that comes up is another opportunity to kind of keep it together, keep things small, and not feel what's really going on. We're so used to it. So in the beginning, it's very claustrophobic, and it, you know, we were talking today about, you know, we all have Oedipal issues. You know, we all were in situations where we were little and our parents were big and they were in control and they were telling us what to do and we did not like it. Because babies, in a certain sense, are full-grown and mature already. And from a certain point of view, they already have the whole experience. Babies do not like being babies from a certain point of view. I think adults actually like being babies more than babies. So we project on the shikantaza the negative authority figure. And I have no problem with that as long as you do the practice. I don't really care what you think because I know it's irrelevant, actually. It's irrelevant unless you believe it, and then we've got a problem. But if you sit in this room long enough, you're not going to believe anything anymore. So you sit and you don't move, and it might be in the beginning, you know, it might be for the first, like for me personally, I like to do in the morning minimum of two sessions. Because usually the first session is, it's what I call updating my files, which means I get up in the morning, I sit down, I do my 45-minute session, and there's a lot of updating, you know, and I don't know where the updating comes from, but it's sort of like my unconscious during the night was processing things, and you know, I see a lot of things about my day, I see things maybe that I want to talk to you about, and it's no problem. You know, you work with the posture, but what you're doing is you're bringing the updating is sort of you're going back and forth like this, and you're actually working on, somehow strangely working on the updating. You don't get invested in your thinking, but it's going on. And it pulls you out, and then you come back, out, back, out, back, out, back. And often that is the process. This is the garbage truck, and he always finds out when I'm teaching. And what happens, if you're not doing the posture, then your mind, you go out with your mind, and you're gone. And it's not a creative process, actually, at all. It's not creative. It's just your discursive thinking building on itself. But if you're doing the posture, and the thinking is going on, you're not really completely 100% invested in it, and the thinking makes a journey. It's very fascinating. The thinking makes a journey. The insights come in. The thinking changes. It's very, very interesting. It's not a bad thing at all that you keep getting pulled out and pulled back, but it's not the most peaceful shikantaza session you ever had. For me, anyway, that first session. I always like to do a second one because what usually happens is by the end of the first one, I'm kind of updated. And during the second one, then something can open up. And something inside and something that is never the same twice, but it's always a surprise and there's a sense of touching not my relative self, but something much more timeless. And then you don't even want to think. You just want to rest there forever. But what I want to emphasize here is there's a journey to that point. And the journey is the shikantaza. In the beginning, it feels very much like an imposition on us from the outside. And it is, you know, before we become familiar with it. And we have to go through that stage. And then we're told, well, actually, you could relax. You know, that's kind of what I was trying to get at yesterday, was you can do this in a way so that you're in the posture which you're actually relaxed. And then this morning, Caroline was helping you see within the posture, and particularly in the lower belly, there's a lot of room in there. There's a big space. There's a lot for you to explore. So, you know, the journey has to happen in that way. It has to unfold. But Dogen, who's the founder of Zen, he was born in 1200, and he had studied in China with my personal, what can I say? There's a Chinese Chan teacher that I think is the greatest Dzogchen teacher that ever lived, named Hong Zhi. And Dogen studied in his lineage. And he, Dogen said that if you sit in the posture in the right way, and I'm adding some words, you know, interpretive words, but the inner space opens and you are the Buddha at that moment. And it's not a metaphor. When you are in the posture in the right way that I'm talking about here, you know, not the very beginning stages, but as you go along, you know, the more you're sort of willing to do it, you are abiding in that awakened state that is what we all long for. You're actually there fully. Now, you could say, why is it like that? Why is the body, why is the posture the gate? It's very interesting. Marpa, who was one of the early founders of the Kagyu lineage, he was the first one in Tibet, and in the 11th century, and he said, if you follow my instructions on posture, you don't have, that's all you have to do. You don't have to do anything else. Now, what's going on there that the posture becomes so important? How can it be the ultimate practice, which I would say it is, more than any other practice that you will ever learn in any tradition? The posture is the sort of highest teaching. Why is that? Because when you are identified with your posture, and you were yesterday, amazingly enough, your ego is nowhere to be seen. And when the ego is nowhere to be seen, the Buddha remains. The true you, what Zen calls your true self, the face before you were born, is there. And you're inhabiting what Zen calls your true life. So you might wonder why we're making a big deal about posture. Well, that's it. That's the reason. It's the gate. I have thought quite often that what, you know, Chandali or Tummo in Tibetan is really a way of learning how to be in your body in the right way. And that's, you know, one of the most advanced of all practices. So that's what we're doing here. And if you wonder why all the emphasis on the body, that's it. There is no other gate. So I encourage you to take a tremendous interest in your body, to listen constantly. And if you've done meditating with the body, of course, this is, you know, you're very familiar with this. But every situation you are ever in, your body has information for you that you need. the information is coming from outside of the ego network. If you're in lunch, in the lunch line, and you're wondering if you should help yourself to certain food, check in with your body. Your body will tell you. If you're with somebody and you can't tell if they're lying to you or if they're manipulating you, check in with your body. If you're wondering, should I go to bed now? Check in with your body. If you're wondering, you're in the supermarket and you're looking at a display of apples and you're wondering, what apple should I buy? Check in with your body. The body in C.G. Jung, the psychologist, talked about the self with a capital S, meaning he was talking about the Buddha nature or the true person that we are. It's ourselves in our completeness. The self is incarnated in the body. And, you know, that egoless person wants to communicate with us, and it does so through our body. So I want to do some practice with you. There's one question, again, that has come up I want to briefly address. Shikantaza is a Zen practice. Today I mentioned Hong Zhe as like my ultimate guru, who happens to be a Chinese Chan master of the 10th century. I thought this was Mahamudra, isn't that Tibetan? Is anybody wondering about that? Maybe a few people, like, what the hell's going on? Here is something that, if I do this extra workshop for you, this optional workshop on history, what we call the Mahamudra tradition in Tibet is the result of the profound interaction of Taoism, Chan Buddhism, and Dzogchen. Mahamudra came out of that. There's a lot of Taoism in Mahamudra, and there's a lot of Chan Buddhism in Mahamudra. We can talk about that later. In the 8th century in Tibet, there was a very famous conversation about what is the best Buddhism in the world for Tibet. And an edict which has been found in the Dunhuang documents, which is, are documents that amazingly enough from that time period were buried and they survived. The edict says the tradition, the most important tradition for Tibet and the meditative tradition everybody should practice is Chan Buddhism. What happened later was the Indian crew showed up and they took over the power in Tibet. You know, Tibetans who had gone to India, this was like in the 11th, 12th century, and they made it illegal to practice anything that came from China. And so all of the records at that time were rewritten to show that everything that was good in Tibet came from India, but actually it's a complete fabrication. There's extensive evidence that Mahamudra is the result of the confluence of Chan Buddhism, Taoism, and Dzogchen. Isn't that interesting? They were part of the same tradition. And you can say, well, what is that tradition? It's the practice of pure awareness. They were all doing it, and they were talking to each other. And one thing you might, those of you who know a lot about Tibetan Buddhism, there's a tradition called Sutra Mahamudra that was taught by Gampopa, who was, Marpa's student was Milarepa, and his student was Gampopa in Tibet. Sutra Mahamudra, it has now been more or less proved, is actually a Chan lineage that was in Tibet. But because of the politics, they couldn't acknowledge their source. And so they said, well, it's just Sutra Mahamudra, comes from India. But it's actually a Chan lineage. Now, you know, I came at this the other way around. Through my Mahamudra and Dzogchen practice, I began actually having renewed contact with Zen. I'd had contact before, and I realized, my God, you know, the Tibetans say Zen is Mahayana. It isn't. It's Vajrayana. It's a Vajrayana tradition. And it's Dzogchen and it's Mahamudra. In some ways, it's more profound. And then I went back to Chan Buddhism, and I found Hongzhi, who has the most fruitional teachings that I've ever come across. And then I went back and looked at the history, and I called up my friends, you know, my academic friends, and they said, yeah, that's how it is. It's the version of Buddhism that has been promoted in Tibetan Buddhism is a complete fabrication, unfortunately. The history, you know, is a complete fabrication. But, you know, go figure, it happened in Christianity, it's happened in every organized religion, so there's no blame. But that's why I draw in my own practice so freely and joyfully on really five traditions. There's Mahamudra, of course, Dzogchen, which is the precursor to Mahamudra. They just gave it a different name, you know, later on. Chan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, and then Taoism. And I might as well just put it out there because, you know, it's part of the puzzle, and I can refer to it. From my point of view, and I'm basing myself on initiates, I'm not basing myself on books alone. I'm basing myself on people who have actually explored these traditions. The most complete tradition of the practice of pure awareness actually is Taoism. And in Chan Buddhism, it's often said that Chan Buddhism is actually Taoism in a Buddhist form, if you know much about it. Taoism is, if you want to know what it is, just listen to what I teach about the sacredness of life, about the fact that everything in the universe has its own awareness, that, you know, we are part of the fabric of the totality, that, you know, our task as humans is to become transparent to the journey of the universe itself as it shows up in us. I've been teaching this, you know, since I was born, basically, and this is Taoism. And I was trying to make Tibetan Buddhism fit into it, or make this fit into Tibetan Buddhism. And it almost fit, but it couldn't quite do it. What happened was the Buddhists saved Taoism in China, because Taoism, after the Han Dynasty, which was over about 200 of the Common Era, Taoism began to become very conventional religion. And the Buddha showed up from India and they realized, holy shit, these people understand more about awareness than we do. And they incorporated the depth of Taoism, and they gave Taoism a container and a practice, and you know, they gave Taoism a way to survive. Thomas Merton said, Chan Buddhism is the legitimate heir of spiritual Taoism. And he was right, you know, good guess, it was a good intuition, and later people have confirmed it. So I have to be careful saying this kind of stuff, you know, publicly, because most people don't know very much about the history, actually, of their own tradition. And it sounds heretical unless you actually look into it, and then you realize this history of Mahamudra is way more interesting than the one that in the sort of, in the stereotype, you know, Tibetan histories we read, because it's open-ended. And what I want to say to you is, and I made reference to this yesterday, our tradition of Mahamudra, that, you know, this journey that we're making, Mahamudra is not a fixed entity. It's not set in stone. It's not a, like, orthodox tradition, and here are the texts, and you practice inside them. You know, that way of looking at it is doesn't reflect how the tradition has really been and how creative it's been. Anytime you have a community of practitioners like this, there is so much experience and so much discovery. And it is out of the ferment, out of the cauldron of that kind of practice that the Mahamudra tradition in every generation is reborn. It's reformed out of the spirituality of the people who practice it. And it's always been that way. Even in Tibet it was that way. But the people who did it in the way I'm describing often had to go away. Kempo Gangcho, one of Rinpoche's teachers, he had too much realization, and so they threw him out of the monastery. He was thrown out. And Trungpa Rinpoche's other main teacher, Jam Khuntra Sechen, there were times in his life when people hated him so much they couldn't even get food for him. And he was, you know, he was like incredibly powerful teacher. And people didn't respect him. And people, they actually threw Kempo Gangcho out because they said, "You're too dangerous, get out of here." That's our lineage. It's a lineage of the practice of pure awareness. But when you say, the most important thing in my life is the eternal depth of my own person and the timelessness of my own human spirit, and when you say, I'm willing to surrender myself into the absolute unknown of reality, then you're making room for whatever may come up. And it's terrifying to you and also to other people. Other people are very threatened when you open things up in that way. But that's what we're doing. And what we're saying here is that's where true life comes from. It comes out of emptiness. It comes out of the unknown. And we're doing the practice in order to make room for it. So again, you know, I very much appreciate that you are... You have so much willingness to open yourselves up and put aside your little security blankets and your little games so that we can be here and rejoice together in the journey. I really appreciate it.
More of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Kechog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.